Hello there, and welcome to Innovators in Care. I'm your host, Reuben Bush, and this is the show where we sit down with thought leaders in health and social care to talk about the problems they're solving, how they're innovating to reduce system-wide pressures and improve patient outcomes. We've been working really hard to put a great show together for you, and I'm very excited for this, our very first episode. Today, we're sitting down with Amy Hassan, service lead for the urgent community response at Dorset Healthcare. Amy is a creative thinker and has been the key driver behind the trailblazing urgent community response service in Dorset over the last few years. She's always bursting with new ideas and ways of solving the problems the NHS faces. And in this episode, we're going to sit down and dive into the detail of how Amy is doing this. Enjoy. So, good morning, Amy. Welcome to Innovators in Care.
Morning.
I wonder if we should start with just if you could give us an overview of who you are, where you come from, and what you're doing now.
Yeah, I'm an occupational therapist by background. I spent 17 years in an acute hospital working in older person's medicine, but my main focus was in kind of urgent emergency care. Spent 10 years leading a frailty team in A&E. We spent a lot of time trying to look at how we can avoid admissions into hospital from ED. And then over the recent years, it's very much looking at how what was coming in through the doors and actually how we could stop that from happening in the first place. So I did a few bits of work around 909 and 111 teams and how we could look at preventing patients coming in, particularly the older, frail patients, which then led me into some work in the community. So I did some pilots of admission avoidance work and piloting a rapid response car within the community services with Dorset Healthcare. Set up a urgent response car for a local primary care network as well, which is still running. And then went back to the Dorset Healthcare community team to help support a intermediate care team, which is mainly therapy based and nursing based. And then got involved with the urgent community response, which is now what I'm doing now, which is service lead for Dorset.
Yeah, okay, that's very good. And I think your background there from being in ED, actually seeing the people come in, gives you a really good insight into what you're trying to avoid in your role now, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've spent a lot of time turning them around at front door and sending them back out to the community with local, you know, local support from the community services. But a lot of the time was questioning why have they come in the first place, particularly, again, the older, frailer patients that are at risk of deconditioning and at risk of infection as soon as they enter our doors in the acute trust. So, yeah, it was good to be able to get back out in the community and start looking at alternative ways of working. That was a good 4 years ago when our local 111 was run by our ambulance service and they had specialist paramedics going out in cars. So we just spent a couple of days, particularly with, from an occupational therapy point of view, with the paramedics and spent that time to start proving different ways of working and actually if you have that bit more of an MDT approach to working and having a good understanding of what's out in the community of keeping kind of high acuity at home and particularly with the older persons kind of being treated in their own home and remaining in their own home and trying to reduce the risk of conveyance, that's kind of where it all started. So the urgent community response work now fits in beautifully with that and it's about stopping them from going to ED in the first place.
Yeah, that's very good. So tell us about what you're doing in UCR currently in your role.
So, like I said, I'm service lead for urgent community response. So I've set it up right from the beginning when it was launched as a paper last year. We've been an official service since April this year. So we're kind of 7-8 months into it. And what we've seen already is a huge development clinically within our team. So I've done all the recruitment. We've looked at kind of how we can change things as we go along and what the capacity and demand is. We're not a specific frailty team, but we focus very much on kind of over 60, because a lot of the data that was looked in with our local ICBs was that, particularly in Dorset, we've got an older population. And there's particular areas in Dorset that have that high demand on the ambulance service, particularly with Cat 3 and 4 calls, your fallers, your frail patients. So we've kind of set the service up, kind of looking at what the demand's like within Dorset. So we have 4 cars. We have one that's based in the west of Dorset, one in the north, and 2 in the east. The east of Dorset is where the demand is for the Cat 3 calls. And it's a mix of professionals. We have OTs, physios, nurses, paramedics, advanced clinical practitioners, and we have assistant practitioners as well. So a whole range from band 4 up to band 7. And we are based in the 111 hub in an integrated urgent care in Dorset. And that's probably where the key thing for me has been, is setting up the service based in urgent care and not within our community teams. We have a brilliant community teams based in Dorset that already provide admission avoidance work, rapid response, supportive discharge. So rather than kind of tagging on what was already existing, it was actually to find the gap, which I felt was within the 111 service, to actually provide a visiting service for 111, but as an extension for the nines as well, to be able to support them with their Cat 3 calls, and particularly the older, frailer fallers. That's our team kind of really kind of homes in on that, because it's an MDT approach. And we've got 4 vans that pretty much have everything in it. So we have all the therapy equipment we can need, but also we've got the community teams, we can access that equipment. We have medications, we have oxygen, ECG, bladder scans. So it's really about being kind of hospital at home, an MDT on wheels as such, and finding that care in people's homes.
Yes, okay, that's really good. And when we first spoke, you mentioned about actually taking a time to train the team up rather than just rushing into offering that service. Could you say a bit more on that?
Yeah, I think nationally, we know we don't, you know, from a staffing point of view, there's a staffing crisis from all different grades and professions. We don't have a lot of advanced clinical practitioners ready and waiting that have also got urgent care skills as well. So I was very open-minded with who I was bringing on board. And it was very much about being an autonomous practitioner, about having those urgent skills, but also embedding that knowledge and skill set within the team. So we've got a variation of backgrounds from paramedics to critical care and acute hospital to community therapy to community nursing. And what we've done is spent the first 6 months really kind of homing on clinical skills and getting everyone's training up, and getting them on advanced practice courses, and sometimes at a detriment of being able to offer some more vans out in the road, it was really important to make sure that we had the competencies and the clinical skills first in order that we could be more flexible about what we take off the 111 queue, because we directly take the referrals off the queue and obviously accept referrals from the 999s or GPs or district nurses. So, you know, we needed to make sure we had the right clinical skill first, in order to kind of not say no all the time to things because we don't have medication or we don't do catheters. Whereas now in 6 months, we've kind of gone from being able to accept kind of older, frailer patients that weren't too complex or needed medication to now being able to accept anything off the queue. It is an over 18 service, but like I said before, we are very much homing in on the kind of the 60s because of the MDT approach to it, or frailty.
Yes. Okay. So I think that really shows, doesn't it, that actually by taking long-term view, but actually putting the groundwork in place properly, what you're actually doing now is far more than you would have been able to do otherwise, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's valuing staff as well. You know, they've all come to work within our team because they saw an exciting opportunity. Some felt within their own jobs before they took the UCR job was that they weren't kind of being developed, so all feeling valued within their own clinical skill set and actually being able to utilise it. So that was really important to me, to make sure the team felt that they were coming to the UCR service and also were going to learn and get on board with advanced practice, getting on the university course or apprenticeship route, and in-house training. We've managed to get a bespoke training set up for urgent care as well. So they've had the last 6 months of somebody independently coming in and doing a bespoke training course for us. Particularly looking at, again, I keep saying frailty, it's not a frailty team, but it focuses on that. But I also believe that if you can get frailty right within your team, you've pretty much opened up most pathways and got that right. So because it's a really complex condition, and it's looking at kind of social, psychological and physical health, it's really important. That's why we've got the MDT. That's why we work in a holistic approach, to look at the whole picture and deliver that care to patients at home. And that's how we try to reduce the risk of conveyance, is because we can hopefully do most things there and then. We can do the bloods, we can do the medication, therapy equipment, but it's also having an understanding of knowing who else to refer on to, things like virtual wards, community therapy teams, back to their GP, or using same-day emergency care clinics.
Yes, okay, very good. So next thing wanted to talk about, Amy, was COVID, the big C word. I think it's changed a lot within the NHS, hasn't it? Particularly around ways of working. Be very interested to get your insight on that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think it's funny, I was on a secondment just before COVID hit and had planned to do something very similar to urgent community response with our local ambulance service. And we had set up a 6-week pilot to look at therapy and paramedics in a car, doing exactly what we're doing now, urgent response from 111 and taking off the calls from the nines and the ones queue. Had it all set up and ready, and then obviously the pandemic hit. Understandably, ambulance service had to kind of withdraw because we weren't knowing what the demand was going to be. So I kind of thought, well, I've done all this hard work. How can I do this in a smaller scale? So I kind of chose a local area that I was familiar with, invited a consultant nurse to work with me, because borrowed them for 12 weeks. And we did our own kind of mini pilot. And we worked in the Bournemouth Christchurch area and proved an urgent response kind of service, which, you know, had great results, like 95% non-conveyance, and particularly with falls, we were keeping 82% of patients at home. So it proved the model really well. But the reason why it worked so well is because the red tape was down, because people were trying to find different ways and alternative ways of trying to reduce people going to hospital. Because we all feared the worst, that we were just going to have everybody in hospital and the demand, and you know we couldn't cope with the pressure. It was really, it's, although an awful situation, it was also exciting because you were kind of given that free rein to be a bit innovative and kind of trial different things. So I think it really, really worked, and lots of things happened during that time. Some of the transformation that worked within our acute hospitals and our community teams was incredible. Very last minute. It was very much about trust, and I think that's what's been noted, is that you were trusted to find different ways of working and kind of given the go-ahead without having to go through months and months and months of business cases or plans and things like that. It was very much, right, let's just do it, let's try it, you know. So yeah, it worked really well. It worked in my favour completely. We proved its worth, and I think that's what's helped support what we are doing now, is because we were able to do those kind of pilots. But yeah, loads of work was going wrong around the time. It was amazing to see, and actually very much kind of led from clinicians as well. And that kind of any solution-based ideas were just like, let's trial it. So yeah, it kind of did us some favours, but post-COVID, now we're kind of trying to get back to some normality. It's very difficult because you kind of go back into your set ways where the red tape's back up, and you know, understandably, to a certain point, but you haven't to write the business cases, you might have to prove your point and your worth. Maybe some of the trust isn't there and we have to go back to formality again, and it's a shame that we haven't kind of kept some of that exciting ideas and solution-based ideas of things like, let's try and find different ways of working and keep that going, and knowing that it did work. And even if it didn't work, it's about trialing another, seeing what didn't work from it and how else can we improve it. And a bit like quality improvement, you continue to kind of plan, do, study, act, and do the next trial. So yeah, it feels a little bit like the red tape's back up again, and we've kind of gone a bit more formal, and you kind of lose that momentum.
Sort of a bit straight-jacketed, sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's someone like myself, I'm quite a creative person, so I like to be a little bit free-willed and kind of do your own thing. So the pandemic suited me really well. And, you know, we proved kind of being a bit different and just trying different things worked. So yeah, I think we could learn a lot from the pandemic and the way ideas were brought in and how change was done. Don't get me wrong, there was a lot of things that didn't work well when you're under pressure and change happens very, very quickly. Staff feel suddenly things are out of their hand. There was a negative side to it. All the good work that went on also has its repercussions on people not being like they're in control of anything, don't know what they're doing, everything changes last minute. So it wasn't all positive and bells and whistles. It was really hard going, but I think from a change of implementing new ideas and services and ways of working was definitely a positive.
Yeah, and how do you think the NHS going forward can avoid, like, take the learnings and avoid going back to how it was? Because obviously there's a balance, isn't there?
Yeah.
Because there's got to be processes in place to make sure patients are safe.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the NHS needs new ideas, new ways of working, doesn't it?
It's a difficult question, but it's, I think it's about trust, and kind of a little bit for me is about leading kind of bottom up and trusting the clinicians on the ground, or kind of operationally led, that kind of work with the clinicians and staff and listen to their ideas, and knowing what, especially when people have worked in the NHS for a while, you kind of see a revolving door kind of happening and thinking, this was what we did 10 years ago, but we're just calling it a different name. So I think there's that kind of acceptance that things have been done before, but actually, why didn't it work? Why wasn't it sustainable? Why wasn't, you know, and how can you continue to develop on that original idea? But it's always about communication. It's always about making sure staff feel valued, and that they feel they're part of the change, and understanding why change is happening, or why a new idea is coming in, or why that demand's put on them to change the way they're working. Mm. We've obviously got the winter pressure paper that came out regards to how we're going to support the NHS through the winter, which is fantastic that you've got all these pockets of money of kind of how we can resolve some of the problems of the current pressure, like attendances to ED and the nines and the ones. But there's also then a bit of a risk, because then we become a little bit siloed, because there's pockets of money going everywhere on existing services already, that actually are doing a really, really good job, but perhaps we just need to be slightly different in the way we work and learn back from what we did in COVID, which was the red tape was down, actually just try things.
Yeah.
So I think, it's a hard, hard question to answer, but I think very much about listening to the ground staff and how they feel things should be managed or changed or led, or what services need to, how they can improve. But most importantly, patients at the end of the day is making sure we're doing right for patients.
Absolutely.
And listening to what they wish for the NHS to kind of look like. The good thing about the urgent community response, it's very much about empowering patients by being treated in their own home. And for me, that's the most important thing, is actually providing that right care, right place, right time. And UCR services is exactly that. It's about providing that quick response in their patients' homes and hopefully treating and keeping them in their own home. I think it's listening to staff and listening to patients.
Excellent. And that's interesting you mentioned about the NHS guidance about winter resilience and community-based falls response. What do you think are the key points from that guidance?
For me personally, it affects UCR in the sense that we're looking at how we can support the Cat 3 type 4 calls that are sat within the 909 queue, and how we can link that with 111 services. So we do a lot of work of validations of Cat 3, 4 ambulance calls in 111, and we stop a lot of that going over to the 9s. Mm. But it's actually how we can work with the 9s to pull off their, or for them to push some of their cases onto our services like UCR, because we know we've got the capacity to be able to kind of take those calls, and the setup of our service is very much about those kind of Cat 3 full frailty patients that are at most risk of getting an ambulance and possibly conveyance to ED. So falls, and how we can use kind of the voluntary sector as well, and third sector, so looking at alternative pathways. So you've got your 9s that can respond to the more serious injured kind of falls, then you've got UCR teams, which would be about level 2, that can respond, but also what's out there, the fire service, first responder teams, and your voluntary sector as well, what they can offer regards to kind of falls non-injury, and then utilising local services for that clinical reviews. We've got the care home work as well, so we've got a project going on with our local care homes that are the kind of high users for the ambulance services with falls. So they've all been given equipment to support patients off the floor and following apps. They can link in with UCR as well if they need clinical advice, but it kind of, that will help support some of the pressure, hopefully for the 9s, but also ED attendances. For me, it's very much about the Fools work. Mm. So we're at the moment looking at exactly what our Fools pathway are, what our provisions are, and who can go and respond to what to increase our capacity.
Yes, because the guidance makes it quite clear, doesn't it, that ambulances, well, it splits up actually into three levels, which confusingly goes the other way category callouts for ambulances. But it splits it up, doesn't it? So level three is an ambulance response. That is only where there is a major injury or illness. Yep. And then it splits up, so level two is UCR, is for minor injury, and then the volunteers, so CFRs.
Absolutely.
And that for non-injury. So it's not, UCR shouldn't actually really be responding to non-injury falls, should they?
No, I think this is a lot about the communication and kind of education to what our service is. So I think we're one of probably the only ones that UCR team that sit within a 111 service, or actually within the hub. But we also do a two-hour response service within our locality team. So we've got that kind of level two sorted that supports GP services, PCNs, district nurses, and then the nines and the ones. We're currently mapping out what services are out there that can support those non-injuries. So it's about education and training, but knowing that they can then have a clinician to call if they need that kind of further advice. But also they've got the equipment like the razor chairs to get people off the floors, to follow the app to know when it's safe to get people off the floor, when to call 999, or when to just call for clinical advice. Mm. So it's really, really important work. So it'd be really exciting to see how those projects kind of play out. But yes, for us, it's we kind of want to take those kind of more complex calls for fallers, even kind of some injuries. We could do wound care now. Like I say, we've got really high-level clinicians, and then escalate it to the nines if, obviously, it does need an ED attendance. But it's looking at alternative routes like same-day emergency care or UTCs or MIUs.
Absolutely. It's about avoiding an ambulance call-out unless it's absolutely necessary.
Absolutely.
Because they are commissioned to respond to emergencies, but not for non or minor injury falls.
Yeah, and the risk we have at the moment is obviously falls and long lie, which we've obviously done loads of work on. And it's those patients that sit in that kind of Cat 3 kind of category that are the most vulnerable. Mm. So for our UCR team in Dorset, that's exactly what we want. We can take off lots of different kind of conditions off the 111 and 99 queue. But really, the falls is the big one for us, is to reduce the long lie. And be able to get them off the floor with our raised chairs and then treat and assess on scene and keep them at home and then provide that kind of wraparound service.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, thanks for that, Amy. Next thing I wanted to go on to was, we've sort of covered the past and where we're up to now. What is on your radar going forward in terms of new ideas, new innovations? What are you working on?
So the UCR team is lucky to be sat within our integrated urgent care service. And within that, we've obviously got the 111, we've got the CAS, which is the clinical assessment service, and our single point of access. But from a visiting mobile car point of view, we have an out-of-hours service and we have a night nursing service. So for me, it's how can we look at an integrated visiting service? And kind of align UCR, the out-of-hours service, and night nursing service together to look at a bit more of a 24-hour approach. We know that UCR, in the future, they want that to be a 24-hour service. So I think we're really lucky that we can start embedding that kind of ethos already and looking at what those current services at night time are doing, who they're seeing, and are there other ways of working, and can we bring the kind of UCR MDT vision into the night team? So it's about aligning the services up, how we can work more in collaboration together, especially from a staffing point of view as well. If we can upskill some of the staff, can we have some blended roles as well? That will help with recruitment and retention.
Yeah.
That's one of the main things, is looking at the three visiting services and integrating them together.
Yeah, and could you just explain what are the differences between the UCR and the other two services?
Yeah, so our UCR service is run 8 to 8, 7 days a week during the day.
Yep.
And the out of hours is 8 to 8 at night time.
Yep.
And they're very much single manned cars, probably more of a medical focus.
Yeah.
And obviously we have a reduction of services at night time, so that's why they're seeing more patients within their own home. Again, it's more patients that are unable to get to an emergency department or an out-of-hours GP or UTCs, etc. And then you've got the night nursing team that are supporting some of the district nurse work that happens in the daytime, so your palliative care patients, catheter care. But we also have another service that's run by the council, roaming nights. That's a really good complement to the out-of-hours workload, because they're providing kind of care provision. They're supporting some of the fallers off the floor as well, the non-injury fallers. So there's it's quite an exciting opportunity to look at how we can get a 24/7 approach to a mobile visiting service that looks in a very holistic MDT way, and can reduce the number of call-outs to the ambulances, and hopefully reduce the risk of conveyance to ED as well.
Yeah. And how are you going about joining those services up? How do you see that playing out in terms of what needs to change and then what it might look like?
I think we need to probably unpick those three services. So obviously UCR is a new service and we're constantly changing and developing as we go along, and problem solving and finding new ways of doing things if we come up to a challenge. So we're really lucky that we kind of started from scratch and we're kind of developing as we're going along and solving the problems that we're going along. And we spent a lot of time, we did an away day to make sure we embed the right kind of behaviours and cultures for the team, and that we could deal with change and sometimes not quite knowing what's coming next. Because that's, you know, that's quite a big ask for some of the team to constantly feel like, not they're making it up, but we're very much a new service, so we're going to have to always keep changing and keeping up with the new challenges and new demands and the asks for the team. So you've got two services that work at night time that have been there for a long, long time and has under lots of different management and different ways of working. So I think really it's to then unpick what they're currently doing, what patients are they going to see, are we meeting the kind of the demands for the population health, what's happening at night time? What else is on the queue that we could be seeing, but maybe we're not seeing because we haven't got an MDT approach to it and that we're just looking either at a medical model. And again, about behaviours and cultures as well, about kind of what's working really well within those teams, but what isn't quite working well and what can we do to make a solution to make that better for patients, for the staff, and very much about recruitment and retention. So I think it's hard anyway to recruit at the moment, but
absolutely
out of hours, unsociable hours is also even more hard. So how do we make those roles look exciting? And it's very much what I've heard so far is that kind of clinical development and career progression. So it's kind of looking at A, what the demand is there for patient care and what's needed, but also what's needed for staff to feel valued and what would make that role more exciting. So looking at blended roles, could they do a daytime, nighttime blend, and things like that. So yeah, different ways of working and how we can integrate together, align some of the services, but also make sure we keep them bespoke to what the service needs, but kind of bringing it together so there's a bit more of an integrated visiting service rather than three separate silo working teams.
That's really interesting, Amy. Where do you think, so sort of moving on a bit, where do you think UCR as if you like, an NHS service, where do you think it should be going in the next few years?
So from a local point of view, I know we need to look at our capacity and demand and do we need to get more cars out there? And I think with the Winter Resilience Plan of looking at the falls provision and looking at the level 1s, 2 and 3, it'll actually engage those other services that can meet that demand at level 1. So there'll be more capacity for UCR to be able to kind of go and see other patients, other conditions and other urgent cases. For me, what was the most important thing was to not reinvent the wheels and make a existing community team suddenly a UCR team by changing its name, because it doesn't really then change the amount of patients coming through that service or how we're already doing. There's so much good work going out that I've said already that they do admission avoidance already, that's their bread and butter. And that supportive discharge and keeping patients out of hospital. There's so much good work out there with the community teams. But the reason I moved it to the urgent care side of things is because it felt that there was something missing in the sense of it was very medical bias. So it was either send either, say, like the out-of-hours team, a medical a person to go out and see that patient, or you get an ambulance, again, which is very medical based. And what I wanted to do was to provide that kind of MDT on wheels and have a multi-professional team going out and responding to patients. So in our vans, we have somebody that provides the kind of medical offer, which is an advanced practitioner, but that could be an OT, physio, nurse, paramedic. At the moment, it's just nurse and paramedics, but in the future, we want to look at much more of the AHP advanced practice route. And they'll always be with a clinician that's either a therapist or an assistant practitioner that's got that therapy background. So for me, it's nationally looking at other integrated urgent care services and looking at where UCR fits in really well with that, and that offering for a visiting service that can provide that holistic MDT approach to patients, which after the last kind of 4 or 5 years, we've done so many different pilots, it proves its worth in the sense of providing the right care, the right place, the right time, but also reducing the number of conveyances to hospital. And for me, that's the most important thing, especially with our most vulnerable, with frail patients, older patients, that, you know, don't do well in hospital, want to be staying at home, those in care homes as well, and protecting them and making sure that we're doing the best care for them within their own community.
Very good. I think you mentioned before about sort of the service getting to the point where it's almost more like an extension of the ambulance service in terms of your capability and what that then does.
Yeah, I think we definitely need to work on how we integrate with the 909 services, and I do see it very much as an extension, an arm extension for their service, to say we're an alternative for them, to particularly with those patients that require a MDT response. And so we've got a lot more work we need to do in regards to integration, collaboration, and kind of that trusted practitioner approach. And how do we get those cases off the queue with the nines over to the ones, particularly in Dorset, where we've got the service set up in the 1-1 service. We know we can take high acuity patients, complex patients, and provide that kind of care, and then provide that ongoing care as well in the wraparound services and the links with the community. And then only if we really absolutely need the nines, that it's a choose to admit, so it's an appropriate admission into hospital. But even at that point, it's trying to avoid the emergency department where possible. So can we do direct admissions into some of the frailty wards or into a medical ward and avoid ED altogether? So there's a lot more we can do and collaborate together across all the different systems.
Yes, okay. And do you think social care fits into this in any way?
Absolutely. I think that's the missing link, is how can we bring health and social care aligned together? I would love to see having social workers within our team. I'd love to see how we can get direct access to care for those patients that we are seeing in an urgent case. And rather than putting a lot of pressure onto our community teams, particularly from a therapy point of view, they're seeing a lot of kind of care package type needs rather than rehab or therapy. We know there's a social care crisis in regards to not having enough care packages and staff for that, but I think we do need to look at how social care plays in this. You know, it's so important that patients are being provided that care following any of our visits or admission avoidance, or, you know, for GPs to ring into social care. So I think we need to work very much together and integrate together, and absolutely would love to have social care directly involved with, particularly with UCR.
Very good. Okay, so I've got a very interesting question for you now, Amy. Stepping back from what you're doing right now and looking at sort of the wider picture with the NHS, if you were in charge of, say, urgent and emergency care at NHS England, what would be your priorities? What would you change? What would you do?
Oh, gosh. There's probably three areas for me. For me, one is about leadership.
Yep.
And looking at kind of different ways of leading and how we can get best out of teams and staff and managers and the way we work. There's definitely kind of a way to kind of lead in the NHS, and sometimes if you're slightly a different leader, it's not always embraced. So I think it's again about cultures and behaviours, and making sure, like I've said before already, is listening to the staff on the ground and also obviously the patients, but those that work every day, day in, day out in these services are often the ones that have those little gems that are solutions that are sometimes really, really simple, but really, really effective. So I'd like to see from a leadership point of view that we embrace different ways of working, different ways of leading and different styles of leading, and embrace those that kind of like to kind of try different things and don't always, a bit like the red tape conversation.
Absolutely.
Don't always like to follow rules all the time. And want to be a little bit creative and try new things and kind of have that trust and valuing staff very much and listening. So different types of leadership, I feel, is something really, really important generally in the NHS.
Yeah.
From what we're talking about today, very much about trying to reduce the silo working, because with silo working is then at risk of kind of the blame game of it's that service, it's that system that's holding patients up or not doing enough discharges or not providing enough care or you're admitting too many people or you're not keeping enough people at home. It's a massive, massive task. And I know we're all trying to find different ways of not silo working, but you know, you're suddenly given a bit of winter pressure money and that goes to some other service that's maybe another service already doing it. And it's trying to find out how we can join up better and have open, honest, frank conversation and being transparent. So to reduce the risk of silo working, which is really about integrated working, open, honest conversations and trust and working in collaboration together. For me particularly, it's, you know, we absolutely need to look at how we work with social care, with the 999 ambulance services and our acute hospitals and making sure we are kind of all seeing the same thing and all wanting the same thing and also understanding where we're all coming from and that we're kind of reaching the same solution. And probably the third thing for me is making sure we have kind of health and social care aligned and some of the conversations that social care sometimes aren't involved with in health decisions. And I think they need to be side by side, especially now with the crisis. We absolutely need to work in a much more integrated, fluid way and make sure that we are communicating and aligning our services together because it comes hand in hand. What's also, I feel, really important is investing time in education and training of your staff, making them feel valued and that actually they're feeling that they're being developed, not just for themselves, but also for the service and for the patients. So we're constantly updating their skill sets and looking at actually what else is out there that we need to be doing in order to meet that demand. It supports us being less risk averse. It helps us make those clinical decisions there and then in a patient's home and hopefully reduce the need of having to get them to being conveyed to hospital because we're treating in their own home. I see that a lot within the ambulance service as well. A lot of the paramedics want to be doing more, and I think that's also something that I would probably want to challenge if I was leading in some way, is kind of how the ambulance service works and looking at how they can improve the way they work in regards to their clinical development and that kind of trusted practitioner approach and being less risk averse. A lot of the patients that we saw when I worked in ED were patients that I felt didn't have to come in. But speaking with some of the paramedics locally, is that they sometimes feel they aren't able to make those decisions to keep people at home, not be able to do things like taking bloods or some medication, or also being aware of what the community teams can or can't do. So I'd very much like to kind of challenge how they work and support them with their clinical development so they can also do some of the convergent community response type work that we're doing and work together. And maybe that's another opportunity, is doing blended roles and joined up working and have joint jobs, working a post between us as well. It's very much about education and training of staff would be a big thing for me. And advancing those kind of clinical skills for allied health professionals like occupational therapists and physiotherapists working in advanced practice roles.
Excellent. That's been very insightful. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How good was that? As always, it's fascinating to listen to Amy and see the passion that she really has.
There are a couple of key themes that I took away from our conversation. I think firstly, the importance of getting the right people in training for the success of a project. And secondly, I think what came through loud and clear is that across the NHS, we need to move away from silo working and actually collaborate, and that embracing different leadership styles and removing the red tape are excellent ways to actually break down these barriers and take the NHS forward rather than being stuck in the past. That's our first episode. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time for episode 2 of Innovators in Care. Thank you and goodbye.